Yo.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. There are those who believe that the public schools are failing our children. Some of those very people also believe that the answer to improving public education isn't more money. And even those government officials who say that we need to support our schools routinely deny the system's budget requests, giving them millions less than they asked for. The Swan Fellowship says we're going down the wrong path. This Charlotte-based organization dedicated to improving public schools says the answer is more money. They say that spending less is a false economy that will end up costing us far more down the line. To paraphrase from their recently published white paper, Education and Poverty in Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools, we need to spend more money on education despite what appears to be an already hefty price tag, because spending less will increase dramatically the far greater costs associated with not preparing a child for a productive life in society, costs for social programs as well as incarceration. The Swan Fellowship says they are working hard to engage the community in conversation about this, to help people understand that when a child fails academically, we all suffer. Today, that conversation takes place here. We're joined this hour by Deacon Jones, chairman of the Swan Fellowship, a retired member of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department. He has a granddaughter attending a CMS school. Welcome to the program. Welcome back, I should say, I guess.
Thank you.
Good to see you. Mickey Aberman is also a member of the Swan Fellowship and a business lawyer with three children in CMS schools. He is also the author of the white paper, Education and Poverty in Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools. Thank you for being here as well.
Good morning.
Reverend Tom Tate has been a member of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board since 2005, representing District 4. He is also pastor of the Plaza Presbyterian Church, has two daughters. His two daughters both graduated from CMS schools. District 4, where is that?
District 4 begins in Sedgefield and goes through Dilworth and then through the hospital area and then all the way out Monroe Road to Mint Hill and then back up through Hickory Grove and down the plaza, basically, to uptown. So it's a middle of the east side, a lot of the east side and part of Dilworth.
You need a gasoline car to get around your district, I think. And Judge Reagan Miller is also with us for part of the program. Judge Miller is a Mecklenburg County Family Court judge who also volunteers in a CMS school, and he has convened an informal court to help deal with children who are at high risk of failing because of truancy and or behavioral problems. His daughter attends Myers Park High School, and I don't know when he has time to volunteer given the court schedule, but he's also volunteered to be on this program. So thanks for being here for at least the first 40 minutes of the show.
Well, thank you, Mike.
Let's begin with Deacon Jones here. First, talk about the Swan Fellowship. There are people who have moved into this city who don't know anything about the significance of the name Swan, where it comes from, what the fellowship is all about, and the fact that it's an outgrowth of the Swan versus Mecklenburg court case in the 1960s that led to the integration of the school system. Talk about that first.
Yeah, back in 1997, a group of people basically came from a lot of churches, and they got together. They were concerned about the plight of the children in the school, and they were concerned that they thought the community was heading down the wrong road as far as it related to integration and a lot of other issues that they were confronted with, or the lack thereof. And they got together to discuss that and to hopefully cause people to dialogue and make things better. And we've been going and talking and doing things ever since then.
Assess your impact over the last several years.
Well, the schools have resegregated around, they say, economics, but the fact of the matter is we now have neighborhood schools. We are no longer the premier integrated system that we said we were at one point in time. So to that degree, I would venture to say that I think that all of our conversations have been for naught. But then again, the community is very transient. We've had a lot of people move in, a lot of people move out, and a lot of things have changed. So to that degree, we're still talking. We're still trying to cause people to understand and look at who we are and where we are as a community and where do we really and truly want to go. There are people who think that, well, we'll save money. The fact of the matter is you're not saving.
Yeah.
You're going to spend the dollars and cents at some point in time somewhere.
Yeah.
So why not spend it on
So even though this white paper, which we're going to spend a considerable amount of time this morning talking about, is the work of one man, Mickey Aberman over here, I take it that the Swan Fellowship is behind his conclusions in this paper.
Well, I think that by and large, we don't disagree with the conclusions that the paper have drawn. Not necessarily agree with everything that's written in the paper, but it causes us to gather together and discuss the issues. And I applaud Mickey's efforts for doing that. Swan doesn't necessarily say that we agree with everything we publish. We want to cause people to sit down and communicate about it. Not just talk, but communicate about the issues. I am trying as best I can to cause people on all sides of this issue to sit down and communicate. I don't necessarily have to agree with you, but I don't learn if I, only thing I if I'm learning is that we agree. I'm really and truly not learning. I need to see this thing from a different side so we can actually address the problem.
Okay. Mickey, why did you write this paper in the first place? What, were you asked to do it by this group, or would you just take this upon yourself one day, get up in the morning and think, I'm going to do some research here and write a paper?
It was probably more the latter.
Wow.
I had, for a good while, been a close observer of CMS and of the community generally, and I sort of felt like there's a gap in the community's thinking about it, that we've got these political debates going on at sort of a 35,000 foot level about funding schools, about overcrowding, about renovating schools, and generally at in a broad policy level about solutions, but we didn't really get down to the basic issue, which is why are children, particularly in the very high poverty schools, not learning?
Mm-hmm.
What are the mechanics of that? What do we need to do differently in terms of teaching them? And if we could figure out what we needed to do differently in terms of teaching them so that they come out with a really good education, then the other decision should follow from that. What do we need to do?
So when you say in the paper that you wrote out of frustration that both sides were missing the main issue is why high poverty children are not learning.
The main issue is that, and what can we do to change that? And what do we need to do to change that?
You describe yourself as a person with no political affiliations, but that you are basically a fiscal conservative and a pragmatist. Now, given that many fellow fiscal conservatives might be surprised by your conclusion that we have to spend more money, not less, what are you seeing that they are not?
Well, first, my conclusion wasn't so much that we need to spend more money as the basic conclusion. That's just, that follows from what we need
right.
to do. As far as being a fiscal conservative, I hate paying extra taxes. I really don't like paying taxes. And I would prefer that they, that the money be spent as efficiently as possible. Having said that, it costs far less to educate a child, even if we spend the necessary money for smaller classrooms, for a face-to-face teaching of a child so that we can, you know, look in his eyes and see that he's getting it and getting the lesson before we move on to the next one.
Mm-hmm.
It costs a lot less to do that than it does to incarcerate him. And if we take these high-poverty schools and we turn out several thousand teenagers every year who have not gotten enough of an education to really be able to be productive and to support themselves in the community, and they haven't developed the impulse control skills that come with going successfully through school, they're still going to be in the community. They're going to be awake and out and about.
With nothing to do.
16, yeah, to 18 hours a day, and they're going to be doing something.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd rather them be productive and have a good job than be breaking in my car.
Judge Miller, we have, as everybody, we've talked about this till we're blue in the face on this program, that we have an overcrowded, overburdened court system. The DA can't prosecute quickly enough. We can't jail them in enough. We don't have enough jail space to jail the people coming to the court system. The court system is bogged down. Is that because of this to a large degree?
To a large degree, yes. I was just sitting here thinking, yes, I see the failures of the system come before me, and then I have to deal with them. Mm-hmm. And I'm of the opinion that if I have to deal with them, it's too late. That there should be some intervention before they come before me.
Is that why you started your special court to deal with?
Yes. In fact, that was an intervention. The courts, and particularly the juvenile court judges, and have decided to be a little more therapeutic in our approach mm-hmm. to jurisprudence. We've started the things such as the truancy court. We also have family drug courts and things of that nature, where we're trying to intervene before the problem festers into criminal activity and things of that nature.
There was a story on NPR earlier this week about a court very much like our drug courts and about the success that they were having. I think it was in Texas with this court system that follows habitual drug users through a long process where they essentially have to report to court, just like our drug courts.
Right.
Several times a week, they got to go for drug testing at the drop of a hat. And it works overall. Is something like this possible for kids who are not being well served by the schools or who drop out of school because they're not being well served and get into trouble to perhaps force them back into the school system and keep up with their activities? Is that something that's possible or even worthwhile looking into?
Well, our approach is to intervene at the elementary school level. Because we and actually our experience is that once they get to middle school and you haven't intervened, then it may be too late at that point. I think you mentioned the dropout rate and kids dropping out. I think the legislature could do us a benefit by changing mm-hmm. the mandatory age from 16 to 18. There's some inconsistency there that I see. But we found that by creating these truancy courts, and I do mine over at Highland Renaissance Elementary School, that intervening at that age, and it's interesting because I think this is very intensive. It's a 10-week program. We get the parents involved. We have the school personnel involved, and I'm donating my time, mm-hmm. so it's not costing the school system any money. But yet there is a funding issue,
right.
even with that collaboration between the courts and the school system. And we're just trying to promote that type of collaboration.
Tom Tate's with the school board. He's also with us. And I know that every year the school board submits a budget to the Mecklenburg County Commission. And every year, for the past several years that I've been aware of, the Mecklenburg County Commission just takes a big hatchet to it and lops off about $20 million or whatever the heck it is and hands it back to you and says, make do. If they had not done that, how much better shape would the schools be in today, in your opinion, given what Mickey Aberman writes about in this report about essentially it boils down to spending more money on education?
Well, part of it, Mike, I think, is not just spending more money, but spending it differently. And we have not been able, as a school system, to bring to scale a lot of the programs that we've instituted.
And everybody around the table is nodding in agreement with you,
right.
So go ahead.
Yes.
Well, and I think part of it is that even elementary school is too late.
Wow.
That the difference, the gap, achievement gap at age 3 is remarkable. And I was a part of an event at the public library a couple of years ago where there was a program in town that's giving a book to every baby who is born in one of our
right.
hospitals.
Right.
Because that may be the only book some of those kids get. That may be the book they have in their home. And so it begins already at that point. We've got to start with the parents and with the children right from birth.
We have to take a break. We're going to come back and we're going to talk about Mickey Aberman's assertion that we all need a collective epiphany. Stay with us. Charlotte Talks made possible in part today by Scott Jaguar, featuring the new XF four-door sedan, a fusion of sports car and luxury sedan with a 4.2-liter V8 engine and 6-speed automatic transmission. Details at scottjaguar.com. And by It's Just Lunch, dedicated to arranging informal first dates for busy professionals. Details available at itsjustlunch.com. Energy has been a major topic of conversation this summer with the rising price of gasoline. It'll be a topic this winter with the rising price of heating oil, particularly in the Northeast, and perhaps even the rising price of electricity eventually, because as oil prices go, so does electricity. Well, it's been on the mind of Jim Rogers for quite some time, too. He's the CEO and president of Duke Energy, one of the largest energy-producing companies in the country, headquartered here in Charlotte. And tomorrow we'll have a long conversation with him about our energy future, about Save a Watt, and much, much more tomorrow at 9.
Analysts claim taxpayers may soon be forced to cover losses suffered by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Why a government bailout seems increasingly likely, and the implications for the home mortgage market and the economy. The Diane Rehm Show, Wednesday.
Join us for the Diane Rehm Show this morning, right after Charlotte Talks, from 10 to noon on 90.7 WFAE, your NPR news source.
Hi, this is Steve Inskeep with Morning Edition from NPR News. Day after day through the presidential primaries, you were able to count on NPR News to bring you the latest.
I sincerely hope that the next president is here this evening.
Partnership and cooperation among nations is not a choice.
As we get closer to November 4th, you can count on us to continue that coverage. Tune in to Morning Edition from NPR News.
Weekday mornings from 5 till 9 on 90.7 WFAE, your NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking today about a report, a white paper produced by the Swan Fellowship for Education, written by one of our guests today, Mickey Aberman. Called Education and Poverty in Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools. Deacon Jones joins us. He's the chairman of the Swan Fellowship. Mickey Aberman is also here, the author of that, a business lawyer in town, Reverend Tom Tate, a member of the school board, and Judge Reagan Miller, a member of the Mecklenburg, one of the judges with Mecklenburg County Family Court and a volunteer at CMS. In the break, Mickey Aberman leaned over to me and said, it's not just about more money for the schools. He's a fiscal conservative, and I know it's not just about more money, but he's one of those fiscal conservatives who sees that money well spent is not money wasted. And you say that we need a collective epiphany, that we have to make major changes. And among the changes that you're recommending in this report is that we change the way teachers in high-poverty schools teach. How so?
Well, I didn't really start out knowing very much about education at all, and I'm still a long, long way from an expert. But the one thing I figured out in doing a good bit of reading in journals and also in talking to people who work in the schools is that children learn as individuals, and that if you have to stand in front of a room full of 20-some-odd third graders and teach them long division when most of them don't know short division, and in fact many of them can't subtract, it's not only going to be a waste of school time, but it's going to be frustrating for the children. They're going to learn that they can't really learn. But if you can start off from the beginning in a pedagogy, in a format where the teacher is eye to eye with the student in, you know, ones, twos, and small groups.
This is where the money comes in, because you're recommending that we reach and teach students from poverty individually. That costs a tremendous amount of money, would seem to me. Where do you get the teachers?
That's going to cost a lot more.
Well, Mike, can I interrupt here just for a second?
Sure.
I think what Mickey is saying is not just the kids from the high poverty school.
Every
kid should be taught individually.
And he mentions in the report that I'm not sure of the right term, but kids who are very bright, high-achieving students, also need the same kind of attention. Otherwise, they'll get bored. And I understand that, but that's a lot of money we're talking about here. No public school in the history of the world has been set up to individually instruct students.
Well, I'm not suggesting one teacher to one student by any means. There's no hope of that, and that's not possible.
Okay.
I'm suggesting much smaller classes. My children have attended a Montessori magnet school in CMS. And, you know, I don't know that the Montessori method itself is the be all and the end all, but it does entail, as an aspect of it, a teacher sitting down with a child, sometimes in ones, twos, threes, or fours, and giving a lesson, and then seeing that they understand it, sending them off to master it, and then coming back, seeing that they've mastered it, and teaching them the next lesson.
That doesn't happen now?
My understanding is that that happens relatively little and much, much less than it needs to, particularly given the constraints that CMS and, you know, a lot of the teachers are under to follow the, keep up with the North Carolina Standard Course of Study and to follow pacing guidelines that entail covering a certain amount of material at a certain time.
I want to talk about that later in the program because that seems to be a concern not only of you in this paper but also of a lot of teachers out there who claim that they can no longer do what they were hired to do because all they do is teach the test, teach the No Child Left Behind requirements, and with very little support from the administration, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But let's go back to this because just before the break, Tom Tate mentioned that this has to begin probably much earlier than elementary school, and I believe, Judge Miller, you also echoed that.
Sure.
So this doesn't. This no longer seems to be an educational problem. It seems to be a family societal problem. What role does the school board or does the school system have to play in that? It seems to me that the bigger role might be in the court system or in the judicial system or in some other system.
I think it's everybody, Mike. I think that's the message that part of this paper is making and at least the discussions are driving home. It's not just the school board's problem. It is also the county commission's problem and the city council's problem and all the residents of Charlotte-Mecklenburg. We've got to find a way to make sure that kids are well-educated as they begin to grow up, mm-hmm. really from birth on, and that their parents know what they're doing and that the community supports them in that. Because the expectations of kids start not just when they enter kindergarten or pre-K. They start long before that. So we do have a social problem. And in addition to that, because we have moved away from even our choice program into what has become almost a neighborhood schools situation, we don't have naturally integrated neighborhoods, integrated in any fashion, whether you're mm-hmm. talking racial or socioeconomics. Mm-hmm. And so that means we're going to have schools that are 99% free and reduced lunch population. Those are kids from poverty. It's not just that they're poor, though. It's because of all the other things that come along with that.
Judge Miller, you not only are a family court judge, but you volunteer
right.
in the school system. What are you seeing when you go into the schools?
Well, you know, and working through the truancy court has given me the opportunity to go to the school and participate in the educational process. And the way the truancy court works, I show up at Highland 7:30 in the Monday mornings for 10 weeks each semester. We have the school counselor there, a social worker, and we invite both parents to come along with their child. And we've identified a problem because the child's been not coming to school, has been truant. And along with that comes the fact that the child has fallen behind. And by inviting the parent there, we insist or inform the parent that, yeah, you're sending your child to school now because we've sent you this notice, but your child is behind, and we need to create an individualized plan for this child to catch up with his classmates. And what I have discovered in doing this is the parents become more involved. There becomes a relationship between the parents and the school that didn't exist before. The child
isn't that the key to it, right?
Oh, that's really the key. And whatever solutions we come up with deal with the family dynamics, deal with the child's specific needs, and plus you have this intensive effort going on to get that child to improve.
Deacon Jones, you as the head of the Swan Fellowship, your organization's been, as you said at the very beginning of the program, involved in having these community conversations about all of this for a long period of time. Most of us have grown up in this country at a time of increasing affluence for society at large. Certainly the country is the richest nation in the history of the world. Most of us grew up in a middle-class environment. Most of us don't understand why it is that children from poverty-stricken families can't succeed in a free public school just like anybody else. Explain that.
I wish that I could explain it to you. I've been sitting here and one of the issues that I have that I'm trying to, and Reagan and I were talking about this earlier this morning, one of the issues that I'm trying to understand myself, we continue to say it's the children aren't learning. The children aren't learning. Could it be that we're not giving the children the information because we perceive that they can't take it or they won't understand it? therefore they don't get it, so they can't perform on the test.
That's real prejudice. Do you think that really exists?
You call it whatever you choose to, but the fact of the matter is when little Johnny's sitting in the classroom and little Johnny's not getting the information, little Johnny's he's not being recognized, he's being pushed to the back, and he's not there. Mm-hmm. Little Johnny's going to act up. He's not going to get it. When you've got parents, and I've heard this time and time again, well, parental involvement. I think that, yeah, you need the parents involved with that child. However, a lot of people that I've talked with feel that, well, the poor parents don't care about their child. That's not true. But you've got to realize when gas is $4 a gallon almost, I think it's reducing now, $3.65, but when a gallon of milk is $5 a gallon.
And a box of cereal is $4.
And it just goes and goes. And then you've got a minimum wage worker. You've got to work three jobs. Do I care about my children? Yes. Do I have? I've got to keep a roof over the child's head. I've got to feed that child. And on and on and on. Do I have time to do all of the things? I want to be in that school. I've got to work.
This is another example of money solving a lot of problems. If you make a decent salary and you have enough money, you have more free time to spend on making sure your child's learning.
That's yes.
That's what you're saying.
Yes, but you understand this, that, and I look back, my parents worked hard and they weren't able to go to the schools as often as I would have liked to have had them there or as often as they would have liked to have been there. However, there was a teacher in that class that stood me up and said, you're going to perform.
Yeah.
I'm going to give it to you, and the expectation is that you perform.
And can I say something here? The key word, and I've heard it used already, is collaboration. And one thing I want to emphasize, because Deacon Jones just mentioned it, the employers in our community have to become involved in this educational process. They have to be willing to give these parents time off to deal with their children's problems at school. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, there is the communication element. Not only if the parent comes to the school, there has to be some communication with the parent about how can I help my child? Because just saying, well, you know, your child's not doing well in school and you need to help, is for some of these parents doesn't mean anything. Giving them very specific things that they can do to help their child, even if it's just as simple as read every night with them.
Deacon Jones just mentioned that a lot of people in poverty are working so many jobs and working so hard just to keep milk and bread available and a roof over the child's head that they really are, they don't have time to make sure that every dot, every T is crossed and every I is dotted on the homework that their kid is doing. But you, who run this truancy court, bring the parents into the equation. How do they have time to come to court and then follow up on the kids and then do their two or three jobs, etc.?
I don't know, Mike. These parents feel that they are compelled to be there because we call it a court session. A lot of times the fathers don't show up, but I've enforced that.
We're talking about strong arming here to a certain degree. That's a very bad word to put on it. But what is that the answer? To say parents, you must be involved and have some structure that forces them to be involved at some point? And is that fair? I mean, if they're out there working, you know, 20 hours a day, is it fair to make them do this?
Is it fair? I think that it's necessary. The fact of the matter is if there's something, if I need to go to my employer and say, look, I've got a court session today, I've got to be in with my child, mm-hmm. they probably are going to say, you need to go.
An hourly worker, they can go, but they don't make the money.
That's true, but I need to go.
Yeah.
If I go to that same employer and say, I need to have lunch with my child today because I'm a lunch buddy at the school, mm-hmm. No, I need you on the line, I need you working. Mm-hmm. Or find another job.
But why not, Mike? Why can't that parent be paid to be there dealing with something that's going to affect our community positively? I mean, this is where I see that the employers have a contribution to make.
Well, Mickey Eberman's paper addresses this somewhat. You want to talk about that?
Well, it addresses it somewhat obliquely because in so many instances, the parents cannot play an active role, and they certainly can't bring to the table what is needed from home. Mm-hmm. Some can't, some don't. But in any event, CMS still has to do the best it can to educate that child. And so the paper assumes that we don't have support, particularly for the children who are in the highly concentrated poverty schools. We don't have that support. What do we need to do at school? And then to the extent that we do have the support, that certainly makes the burden easier to carry, and that's great. But we've got to start with the assumption that for many, many kids, the parents aren't going to be part of the equation. But we still have to educate these children so that we don't have to deal with them at 16 or 18 without the foundation to that education provides. Otherwise, I think it's going to, as I said, cost much, much more to the taxpayers than spending the money in school now.
According to the Board of Education website, CMS provides all students the best education available anywhere, preparing every child to lead a rich and productive life. Reverend Tate, member of the school board, District 4, you told one of our producers that board members realize that we are not educating everyone. Why the contradiction?
Well, that's our mission and vision, and it is our vision to have that kind of education for everybody. And I think that we are working in that direction, but we are working against great odds. It's not poverty that is the problem. Poverty becomes a kind of proxy for all the other problems that come to school that we have to address as a whole community. The other part of it, though, is that in this era of accountability, we have said to teachers, you've got to teach what we tell you to teach. And we've done that particularly in elementary schools. Now, our K-3 intensive kindergarten through third grade intensive reading program, I've supported completely. But if all it does is to drill the ability to read words without comprehension, mm-hmm. which is the worry that some people have about it, then we haven't educated those children. We've taught them to sound out words. We've taught them how to read a passage from a book, but if they don't understand it and can't answer a question about it, then we haven't helped them. And that's where we've got to break really through the whole accountability system that we have through No Child Left Behind that requires us to get all of these kids up to adequate yearly progress by 2014.
But you also told us that doing what we are doing, reducing class sizes in our focus schools and paying teachers and principals to go to those schools while not changing the school's demographics, is probably the most expensive way to try to educate all of our students. What does that mean?
Well, that's my opinion.
Okay.
What does it mean? What it means is that the studies that I have looked at that make the most sense to me indicate that where we have a good balance of kids from all walks of life, everybody does better.
You're talking about reintegrating these schools. Let me ask you, Deacon Jones, that you mentioned you were the first person to talk about how we have resegregated the school system through the repeal of laws, et cetera, and the school choice plan of 2002. Can you track on a grid somehow a decline in learning rates or a failure of higher poverty children as a result of this?
I think that if you look at when you start talking about poverty rates and failure of children, if you look at the school system as a whole, where it is today, the success of children with as far as passing the test or whatever, and compare it to where it was before, I think you'll see a decline.
You think?
Yes.
Has anybody done a study on this, Reverend?
I have not seen a complete study on exactly where we are today as a school system. But I do know that when you look at the data, that you're much more likely to get an education if you're not at a high-poverty school. And that's what the data does show us.
We have to take a break. We're sitting around the table here with Deacon Jones, chairman of the Swan Fellowship, Mickey Aberman, who's the business lawyer and the author of a white paper by the Swan Fellowship called Education and Poverty in Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools. Reverend Tom Tate is a District 4 representative for the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Board of Education. And Judge Reagan Miller has to leave us now. He's a member of the Mecklenburg County Family Court and a volunteer at CMS. I thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you, Mike.
We're coming right back.
Having me here today.
And Mickey. Our program is made possible in part today by Hendrick Lexus in Charlotte, presenting the LS. The experience is available for test drives at Hendrick Lexus, your local Lexus dealer, and by CPCC Institute for Entrepreneurship's New Ventures Entrepreneurship Certificate Program, the essentials to starting a business. Beginning today, 704-330-4223. At 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, stock prices of housing giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac tumbled this week amid growing concerns that a government bailout of these institutions is inevitable. Fannie Mae's CEO Daniel Mudd talks about the future of his organization and the troubled housing market. You mean his name is Mudd? Okay. And coming up at 11 o'clock, listeners are invited to join a panel discussion of what some critics have called the best novel to emerge from World War I. That novel would be A Farewell to Arms by Ernest Hemingway. That's all upcoming later this morning. We have a lot of ground to cover, but if you'd like to join our conversation, we'll try to squeeze you in. Our numbers are 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, or you can join us on our blog at wfae.org/charlotteblog. We're coming right back.
I'm Tom Ashbrook, host of NPR's On Point. We've had some great conversations lately. Jeff Bezos on the internet, George Will on the GOP, Hong Huang, China's Oprah on Shanghai, Geraldine Ferraro on Hillary Clinton, Tom Brokaw and Chris Matthews on the media, and Rice on Jesus. Come hear who's next. Join me for the next On Point, weeknights at 8 on 90.7 WFAE.
While you've been on vacation this summer, WFAE's news team has been hard at work covering the breaking news.
Wachovia plans to cut 600 more jobs than previously announced.
And the stories that make summer special.
I see these kids come running out, yelling and waving, and I think, oh no, they want ice cream, they're going to be so disappointed, but no, they wanted the books. And they're like, the book people are here, the book people are here.
Catch all the WFAE stories you missed while you were away. Go to WFAE.org.
We're back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're sitting at Spirit Square with Deacon Jones, chairman of the Swan Fellowship, Mickey Aberman, the author of Education and Poverty in CMS. That's a white paper written on behalf of the Swan Fellowship, and Reverend Tom Tate, a member of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board representing District 4. Is there any political will for reintegrating the school board or the school system prior to the way it was prior to the court decision to stop busing for integration and prior to the school choice program?
If I base that desire on email or on phone calls, I'd say no.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of conversations, there's a lot of desire to do something better than what we're doing, recognizing that in every school, kids are achieving well. I mean, low-poverty schools, high-poverty schools, there are kids achieving well. It's just that when you look at the overall picture, they don't do as well in high-poverty schools as they do in low-poverty schools.
And yet in the break, you told me there's a study that shows that kids, high-poverty kids in high-poverty schools don't necessarily fail.
No, paraphrasing. Yeah, that wasn't quite what I was saying.
Okay.
I said that there was a study that showed that disadvantaged children, high-poverty children, will tend to perform better in a low-poverty school than the same children or same child will perform in a high-poverty school. Mm-hmm. And that was in a study that I think was a peer-reviewed study. There's also a good bit of anecdotal evidence that the middle-class child will perform more poorly mm-hmm. in a high-poverty school.
Yet,
so it goes both ways.
And you told me that your paper is an attempt to deal with the cards that we have been dealt in the reality that we face here today, but it also says that poverty has been progressively concentrated in CMS schools since desegregation, since the introduction of the Choice Plan of 2002, and you say the problems that poverty presents don't increase proportionally, they compound. Why?
That is true. And again, studies show that it requires a greater effort on a per-child basis to educate children in a high-poverty school or educate the same child in a high-poverty school than it does in a more affluent school. And part of the reasons for that are obvious. If you've got a school which is 99% high-poverty, you're going to have many fewer moms there during the day. You're going to have fewer people who have time to be out in the hall reading with children. You're going to have PTA is going to be less able to raise money for classroom materials. And there's a lot more demand on the teacher's time because the teacher has a lot more children in the classroom with greater needs.
Let me share with you a couple of emails that have come in the course of the program. One, Kevin writes, education has zero to do with money. The kids are the entire problem due to poor parenting. We now spend way more per child, and teachers are far more educated than before, and students are performing well. My plan would not cost anything. I'm excerpting this a little bit. In the high-risk schools, go back from 16 to the standard number of kids per teacher, then have the existing extra teachers provide one-on-one time for those that need it. In schools like Garinger, there are only 500 students due to class size reduction, so there are twice as many teachers as the regular high schools. This would entail reading and math specialists.
I don't think that'll work just the way he suggests it does. When we do reduce the size of a school for whatever reasons, we don't have this necessarily the same number of teachers, and that so we don't have those extra teachers hanging around to do that necessarily that one-to-one time that he's suggesting.
Anonymous writes, my father often said his family had squandered their wealth and education was something he could give his children and we could not lose. It was a wonderful idea. One of the greatest failures of our system, says one of our other callers, our writers, Lou, is the elimination of trade and career preparation from the middle school curriculum during Dr. J. Robinson's tenure. He's advocating, obviously, bringing that back. Is that something that should be looked at? Not everybody is a college track student.
The fact of the matter is, when I was going to school, Mike, public schools prepared you for one of two things, either higher education to go on to college or prepared you to go into the workforce. The children now, the workforce, a lot of them, the workforce they're going into is committing crimes. So, yeah, I think that there is a place for those children who need to learn to be a plumber, learn a trade. I mean, plumbers make a lot of money, and the list just goes on and on and on. And we're not preparing those children for that. We're not.
And if they're not academically inclined in high school or middle school, they're going to lose interest in before they get to the stage where CPCC can help them, it would seem to me. Correct?
In all probability, yes. They will probably not get there until later in life because they're probably going to be one of those people that we don't track very well, the dropout.
All right. Put your
We have opportunities for kids to receive career and technical education for the very things you're talking about. Whether we have enough is a question, but we do have those. And we have a technical high school, Philip O'Berry High School, so that kids can learn for specifically the kind of trades that there are now in computer and technology and auto mechanics.
Let's take a couple of phone calls quickly here. Let's go to Mike in Huntersville. You're on WFAE, Mike.
Hi, good morning to all of you. My basic question is, as I listen to this conversation, is I've heard it before, many, many years ago, and for succeeding years. None of this is new information. I guess my issue is, and my problem, my concern is, why haven't we as a society actually implemented and done something about it? I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you.
I have the same concern.
Yeah. There's no political will for this, is there? Obviously.
Well, as a school board, we recognize that that student assignment does have a part to play in this, but it's not the full part. And so student assignment is something I think that we have to address as a school board, as a school system. But again, the whole affordable housing in all parts of Charlotte-Mecklenburg is a critical thing so that we have kids living all over the community to be a part of all our high schools. We may not be able to go back to the kind of busing plan that desegregated the schools years ago. But we've got to do something to find a way to educate these kids. And that's what I'm about, and that's what I think the majority of the school board wants to work on.
Has the school board read this report yet? Have you shared this report with them, or do you know what their reaction to it has been thus far?
I have not talked with school board members about it. It's my understanding that they received it, but I have not talked with anyone about it.
Mickey Aberman, you wrote this, and you're a fiscal conservative, and yet you write that fiscally conservative, and I keep bringing that up because money is the crux of this, but although it's more than money, but you're talking about spending substantially more money. And you're saying that fiscally conservative citizens shortchange themselves by not ponying up to rescue low-performing, high-poverty schools. Why don't they get this, in your opinion?
I don't know. I think that we've got a certain amount of short-term fixation in our culture.
A certain amount.
Well, we got a lot. And we, in business, we don't think past the next quarter. And I think in public affairs, we sometimes don't think past the next year. Mm-hmm. And this is more of an investment issue because the child that isn't learning to read in kindergarten or first grade, to use my point earlier, is not going to be breaking into my car probably for another several years.
Maybe that's the word that ought to be used. That's a word that a lot of fiscal conservatives use, investment.
That's really what it boils down to, because we have to start spending money now before we realize the benefit of it, because the children have to obtain the benefit of a good education and mature to see what happens.
Before I go back to the phones, one of the things that you point out in this paper is that it costs a lot less money to spend that money on educating a child than it does to spend that money on incarcerating a person after they've gone failed through the system and have to resort to a life of crime to support themselves. What's the differential?
Well, the numbers I've seen vary somewhat, but at present, I think the last I saw was that we're spending $8,000 to $9,000 a child to educate them, and I'm suggesting we need to up that sum. And the lowest number I think I've seen lately for incarceration is $26,000.
Is the problem here that the money for incarceration comes from a different pot than the money for education, a different source, state money versus local money? Is that part of the problem here?
It's still my pocket.
Yeah.
It's still tax money. That is the issue. Where do we want to spend it?
Yeah, but see, that's not fair, because the county gets their money from property taxes, and the state gets their money from income taxes and some excise taxes and fees and other sources. There's a great hue and cry every time you try to raise somebody's property tax. So is it fair if education money comes from the county, most of it, much of it, and the only way the county gets their money is from property taxes, isn't that the problem?
Well, that is a problem. We need to find other sources of money. Just to be clear, though, that most of our money comes from the state in the form of a lot of the payment for our teachers, though we supplement that at the county level.
Okay.
But it's about a third that comes from the county at this point.
All right. Let's go to the phones again. John and Charlotte, welcome.
Hello. As someone who's opposite of Judge Miller, I work at a university, so I get to see the successful people who walk away from this system. But I'm also like Mickey, I'm a fiscal conservative, and I don't like throwing money at a problem, but I teach business, and I understand that the initial investment will show the ROI on the end, not just in the way of preventing incarceration, but looking at welfare programs and things along those lines. Now, I've heard it mentioned several times, parental involvement. I don't like the term involvement. What about parental commitment? My parents worked 12, 14 hours a day when I was growing up, but I was committed to getting an education because I was told I need to make something more than rather end up where they were.
Parental commitment, I think, is invaluable, and we want to encourage it every way we can. But kind of like the existence of high-poverty schools, I think that we have to work with the cards that are on the table, and we have to deal with the fact that we've got a lot of parents who aren't going to be able to provide a commitment.
You know, it's... go ahead.
But that to me is part of the problem. I mean, it's just like, okay, well, here's what we have, so let's deal with it. That's not where we stand. As a parent who has three kids here in Charlotte-Mecklenburg, one getting ready to enter kindergarten, if I have to work, I have to work, but that doesn't mean I'm not going to be committed to his education.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, I agree with you. I'd want every parent to be committed. I just don't want to stop and sit on our hands until we find a way for that to happen.
John, thank you for your call. Why do you think it is that there's a disconnect, it's a societal disconnect, that education leads to success, that success leads to a better life, that you can afford more things, you can afford a more comfortable life? We provide all these kids with a free education. Why is there this disconnect that education's not for me? It doesn't mean anything to me. I'd rather be a basketball player. I'd rather be a football player. I'd rather be Britney Spears.
I don't know. First of all, I would have to disagree. I'm not so sure that we're providing all of the children with an education. Okay. I've been in the classrooms. I've watched the children. I've watched and I've heard the conversation today to the extent that after elementary school, if we've not after third grade, if that child's not reading on grade level, that child's on a downward spiral. That's mm-hmm. a fact. So if the child can't read, if the child doesn't comprehend, if the child is not understanding what's going on in the classroom, that child is not being educated. If there's an assumption that because you're sitting there that you're being educated, that's not true. And one of the things that I think we very quickly need to understand, too, I care about my children. I love my children. I'm working three minimum wage jobs. However, I have the, how should I say this? I find myself, I dropped out of Charlotte-Mecklenburg school system too. So I don't understand the homework that's being sent home to my child. Mm-hmm. I don't have the wherewithals to give my child mm-hmm. what I want, really and truly want to give that child. So I've got a little bit of a dilemma too. So and there's no place that I can go because I'm working three and four jobs.
Well, this brings up this emailer's point. What are the panel's thoughts on providing room and board for kids at struggling schools? If not through CMS, then what about a nonprofit to provide the housing? So in other words, there's some structured adult supervision of these kids' learning experience.
We've actually had some offline conversations on the board to talk about whether or not that would be possible for some of our schools, or at least a school in Charlotte-Mecklenburg, that it could be mm-hmm. one of those interventions to help kids get the support 24 hours a day that they really need.
I only have 2 minutes left. The crux of this is we're going back to money here. It will cost more money to do what you're suggesting we do in this report and that you think it's urgent that we do in this report. But in the interim, we also have to fund jails because you say we've kind of lost a whole generation or more of kids. And high school, we've kind of lost them if they're in high school and struggling. So how do we fund both more jails, a bigger court system, and more money for education at the same time, until we get the problem with education solved?
It's tough, but I think that the alternative is that we have to continue to fund still more jails, and that's just part of the cost of a failed education. Meanwhile, I think we can start small and assure ourselves that the new approach works, and I think that if we had a couple schools where we really tried an intensive learning in elementary school, it would spread if it was successful.
In 30 seconds or less, what happens to this report now? Does it have a champion at the school board? Does it have a champion at the administration, on the county commission? What happens?
Well, I think it needs to be read by the school board, and I will be in conversation with them to make sure that they all have received it, and we get to talk about it.
You can also read this report yourself by going to the Swan Fellowship website. You want to give that address?
Swanfellowship.org.
Okay, and that's S-W-A-N-N, fellowship.org. Deacon Jones is the chairman of that organization. Mickey Aberman wrote the report, Education and Poverty in Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools, and Reverend Tom Tate is a member of the school board. Judge Reagan Miller joined us earlier in the program. Thank you all for being here. Thank you for your time. And thank you for writing the report.
You're welcome.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Our senior producer is Wendy Herkey. The associate producer is Tim Ross. Aaron Sutton is our research assistant, and our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks archives, upcoming shows, and podcasts, go to WFAE.org.
And we have a link to the Swan Fellowship on our website as well. Our program made possible part today by Bank of Granite, now offering Granite mobile banking for cell phone access to online accounts. Bank of Granite, now with state-of-the-art service as solid as our name, on the web at bankofgranite.com. And by Signature Healthcare, Charlotte's concierge medical group, providing patients with 24/7 physician access, individualized attention, executive physicals, and same-day appointments. SignatureHealthcare.org.
Every 4 years, Democrats and Republicans gather to nominate their candidates for president.
Accept the nomination of the Democrats.
I have the highest honor of accepting your nomination.
I proudly accept your nomination for president.
This year, John McCain and Barack Obama will accept their party's nominations. Join us for special coverage of the 2008 conventions from NPR News. Coverage starts Monday, August 25th, here on 90.7 WFAE, your source for news this election year.
I'm Mike Collins. All of us are thinking more about energy these days, but Jim Rogers is even more focused on it. He's the CEO of Duke Energy, one of the largest electric power companies in the United States, serving 4 million customers. By their own admission, they are also the third largest emitter of carbon dioxide in the country and say they are committed to reducing that profile. Jim Rogers joins us to talk about Duke Energy, about how it fits into a lower carbon future and more when Charlotte talks tomorrow at 9 on 90.7 WFAE. Sunny, lower 90s today, and then partly cloudy tonight, mid-60s, upper 80s tomorrow. And there's some chance of showers, but not much. 81 degrees right now at WFAE Charlotte, WFHE Hickory, your NPR news source.
From WAM.